Interesting, thank you for that. And in Canada and the United States, we also have a lot of issues around Aboriginal health, and it's one of the questions I'd like to talk to you about later on is, you know, how is PAHO looking at Canada and the United States and around Aboriginal health issues, which I think is very important. Thank you. I'd like now to introduce Carol Comfort. I hope I have pronounced your name correctly, Carol. And Carol holds a PhD and is a psychologist and a professor of health promotion and education at the University of Utah. She specializes in cross-cultural research and dissemination of evidence-based family-strengthening interventions to prevent substance abuse, delinquency, child maltreatment, and to improve child outcomes. From 1998 to 2000, she served as the director of the DHSA Center for Substance Abuse Prevention in Washington, and she was honored with a White House Distinguished Service Award for that. And for 15 years, she was also she directed the National Institute of Justice (OJJDP) Strengthening America's Families Initiative to locate and disseminate evidence-based family interventions nationwide. And she's currently United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime Consultant. And she's received several awards and citations for her work and her research. So I would like to welcome Carol to come and make a presentation on global dissemination of evidence-based family interventions to improve health policy. And I want to listen to that because I'm the advocacy guy for us in Canada. So I'm going to listen. You're going to teach me some stuff.
Well, we've gotten calls from 8 different cities in Canada this last week that they're putting out a big grant for $1.5 million for each city. As Jim said, these are all my credentials. I'm towards the end of my career, so I've just done a lot. But mostly it's about trying to get evidence-based programs that are family-based, because I'm a great advocate of family-based interventions for all kinds of health issues, including what you've been talking about. Actually, one of the programs that's being disseminated by the UN is the PAHO version of my Strengthening Families program around the whole, I'll talk with you about it. Yeah, I came out mostly out of the area of alcohol and drug abuse prevention, first treatment, and then I was like, okay, we can prevent this. If it's a family disease, we can prevent it. So I'm going to be talking about the impact of drugs very briefly on the children and family risk and protective factors, solutions, which are the evidence-based parenting and family programs, steps to cultural adaptations and what you can do. And I do need to disclose that one of the programs that's being disseminated by PAHO in the UN is my own Strengthening Families program. So my husband does want a company to disseminate those called Lutra groups, so there is a conflict of interest. But I'm disseminating all evidence-based programs. No discrimination there. So when I came to Washington in 2007, there was a huge issue with legislators just wanting a magic bullet, a quick solution, bippity-boppity be gone, alcohol and drugs be gone. They just wanted to do media campaigns. And we know to change behavior it takes more than just media. So I had been doing this work for the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention in NIJ, and we collected all of the best family and parenting programs and put them on a website for them. But in the meantime, I had all this research, so I collaborated with Nan Tobler, who does meta-analyses, and had her say, okay, you've already published on all the school-based programs and how large the effect size are. Let's do it for all the different categories of family-based programs. And that's when we discovered that actually the family-based programs have effect sizes for reducing alcohol and drug use and delinquency that were 9 times larger than the school-based programs. So if you really want to have a major impact, you need parenting and family programs. So parenting skills training, family therapy, and family skills training, and home family support, which is quite expensive, but has a huge positive impact. And we also looked at, people have done cost-benefit studies. So this is not all my research, but I publish on an overview of all the research. That last one was my research. They found that family skills training programs save about $9.44 for every dollar spent. My Strengthening Families program has about $11 saved per family member, so it's about $33. And actually, juvenile corrections approaches without any kind of family approach actually cost more money because you're putting kids into schools for crime when you aggregate them into centers. This is also the cost benefit for my program, which is the highest in terms of the SAMHSA study by Miller and Hendry And what they found was that about 18% of kids are prevented from using alcohol, 15% from marijuana, 10% from other drugs, and 7% for tobacco. So parents do matter, and we need to consider that in all areas of health. In fact, I think, and any of you are looking for a career in the future, obesity prevention. I don't think we're really going to be able to solve the obesity prevention problem unless we start considering the parents and the family and that whole family environment. So parents and elders are the primary role model for their children. Drug-exposed children are, of course, highest risk for alcohol and other drug problems and other problems, delinquents, crime. I was pleased when I got to Washington. I was trying to get more money for family-based programs because we now had about 35 of them that we'd found for the National Institute of Justice, and I wanted money to get them disseminated through Center for Substance Abuse Prevention. And luckily, this study came out, which was a National Longitudinal Adolescent Health Study. And what they found, actually, was that nothing was important in every area of health than parents. So this was a cartoon that actually came out in our newspaper in Salt Lake City. It said, study finds teens actually listen to their parents. And what I had noticed over the years was that parents were being told it's all the negative behaviors of kids is peer pressure. It's teen. What's happening to teens, they only listen to their friends, they're not going to even listen to you. And parents were giving up. They were just giving up and moving away from their kids and not staying connected during the adolescent years. So we had a 16-year-old daughter, and yeah, my husband and I, we would have the same reaction, well, whatever, just don't do this in front of my friends. She was asking us to drop her off 2 blocks away from school, so no one would see, we kissed her goodbye. I also asked for a special analysis of our Monitoring the Future, which is the high school study every year to determine how many kids are using. And when we did that, we found out that the primary reason to use may be the teen friends, but the primary reason not to use is the parents. So parents, this is a major important message to the parents. Also, I did a study for NIDA looking at all the other research, not my research, but summarizing what were the biological and genetic factors that lead to high risk, because there certainly is a genetic tendency. And these were some of the risk factors we found. What's the phenotype? What is the phenotype? The psychiatrists are asking, what does the phenotype look like? So this is what there was. What I've gotten very excited about recently is epigenetics. So people can have genetic reasons for a disease that they've inherited, but it doesn't have to be manifest. And one of the most important studies that's been done recently with mice was nurturing parenting. So if they have a licking, grooming mother mice, even though it's a knockout mice for obesity, they're not going to, and they spend a lot of time with that mother mice, they're not going to develop obesity. And so I was wondering, does this actually impact with humans? And yes, studies have been done suggesting that. And I just discovered that my own program have been done with, they actually did saliva tests with the University of Georgia with Gene Brody with using Strengthening Families 10 to 14 with African-American families, and they took the high-risk kids that already had the serotonin transporter short alleles who are high-risk for alcoholism and looked at them 5 years later and found that compared to the kids who had the same short alleles, that there was a 50% reduction in alcohol use. So it is... nurturing parenting can make an impact not just in mice and rats, but in humans, and impact whether or not they're going to show this tendency towards alcohol and drug abuse. They've looked at it also for depression and delinquency, and it was reduced. These are some of the risk factors from my first study in drug-abusing parents that helped us design this study. These are the protective factors. But how do they order themselves? They order themselves by, we did a study at SAMHSA. We had data on almost 10,000 kids, but valid data on 8,500, and did structural equations modeling for positive child outcomes. We tested it for 4 different outcomes, substance abuse, delinquency, teen pregnancy, and school failure. And we found that it was all the family factors, bonding, supervision, family communication of positive family values actually collapsed with peer values and norms. So a family who does spend time showing and talking with their kids about their expectations, their positive family values, those kids are less likely to hang out with negative friends. The community environment was statistically significant, but the size of these arrows and the beta weights are show the importance of those factors. And it turns out for girls, F stands for girls, M stands for males, family was even a little bit more important, which I think is what contributed to our high increase in the mid-90s in drug and alcohol use and delinquency in girls, because families were breaking down. Parents were disconnecting from their kids. So solutions, whereas youth-only programs tend to decrease over time, family programs only increase over time, and they impact so many different outcomes. These are some of the resilient skills that family interventions can teach, and mostly all the ones we have on our websites deal with all of these kinds of factors. So what are evidence-based programs? You guys know. Don't go this fast. The good news, we have lots of good programs. Bad news, prevention is not easy. We want to build a bridge. That's what I've been about my whole career, a strong bridge between research and practice, and a vision for the future that we can get this out globally all over, so that different governments will be picking up evidence-based programs for all kinds of health solutions. So the first study I did was for the National Institute of Justice, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. We searched and we found about 35 programs. Only 7 of those were what we considered exemplary one programs, which is they had high effectiveness, high effect sizes, and had been independently replicated. So you always want to ask if an evidence-based program has been independently replicated by other research teams, because maybe it's hard to disseminate it or get the same results somewhere else. These were the family programs that we found were the best ones. In the UN study, I added this one from Australia. These were all US programs, but also Triple P from Australia was added. Okay, so that study for the UN, we looked at a literature review on over 500 articles. We had international expert meetings in Vienna in 2007. We wrote a guidebook for family strengthening interventions, and we decided there were about 65 model programs, and we put 25 of them up on the website that were the best ones for other countries to be able to find. The UN is disseminating those programs to 4 different regions of the world, so they have picked about 5 countries around the Central Asia, also the Balkans, and the Panama region, which is what they're doing, the PAHO version, actually, of my Strengthening Families program there. And I've been mostly involved with the UN Office of Drugs and Crime in Vienna, working with them on disseminating it to 6 different countries in Southeast Asia. We've already done Thailand. We've already trained them. We've got good outcome results from them, and also for the Burmese. And we're starting in China and Vietnam next. So I'm also a big advocate of taking evidence-based programs and culturally adapting them. And we have research showing in 5 different 5-year studies with different ethnic groups that we did the program basically as is for Strengthening Families, and then for the next 2 years we did a culturally adapted version. And the results were the same. The outcome results were the same, but what was different was 40% better recruitment and retention. So with all these different, we're now in 27 countries in the world, and we find that these are the most important steps to doing cultural adaptation, and cultural adaptation is really, really important. So I've got 1 more minute. So you should translate the curriculum and the training materials. And when you do the training in the other country, you want to have indigenous people there that have been working with you who can be co-trainers in that language. And that's the way we do it. You've got to change the graphics, the stories, the songs, everything to reflect that culture, and anything that is totally inappropriate. Like in the Native American tradition where I come from, you don't look your elders in the eye, and a lot of cultures are like that. Whereas in the white culture, in the speaking, listening, we say, yeah, you should look your parents in the eye. So we say basically implement as is with minor adaptations. Do not remove core content or shorten it. Work with the local people, continuously make those adaptations, and evaluate. So the only way we can say whether or not the adaptations they've done has actually worked is to actually do the evaluation. Some countries are saying, well, these are evidence-based programs, so we don't have to evaluate them. Wrong. You're doing them in a totally different context. You have always got to do at least, it doesn't have to be a research quality evaluation, but at least a field study evaluation with pre-test, post-test. And then disseminate the culturally-adapted version if it's effective. So then support the country to develop their own training and dissemination system. Pick out, whenever we go into a new country, we pick out right away in the first trainings what we consider the true believers, those people who are going to carry the program forward because they have personal charisma and lots of connections in that country. Co-train with them, support their grant writing, and support website development. How do you get families to attend? Personal invitations, meals, transportation, child care rewards. We do everything to remove all barriers. And what you can do to help, so this is in conclusion, learn about evidence-based family programs. They're not effective for just alcohol and drugs. They are effective for every area of health. And advocate funding for them, educate staff, and encourage parents to attend and find funding for culturally adapted evidence-based programs. Family programs are more costly than just going into a school and having teacher deliver the health messages. However, with new technology that can be changed, we have now developed a DVD, a home use DVD that costs $4. At cost, we're disseminating and getting the same kind of results as the 14-session group version that costs $1,400 per family. So I think if we can move more towards technology, we're going to be able to get these family programs and get them on the web for free. Anyone can download them. So thank you very much.